Today, our speaker is Bill Booth. Bill is an attorney at the Jacksonville Advocacy Project.
No, Legal Aid in West Palm.
Okay, I'm sorry. The bio I have says Advocacy Project of the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County. So now it's just attorney with Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County. Is that correct, Bill? I just want to make sure we get it right for the website when we post it. Okay, he has represented children for 7 years.
About 7.5, yeah.
And dependency, delinquency, education, and mental health cases. With that, I will hand it over to Bill.
All right, thank you. I did a PowerPoint, which you should have. Hopefully you have in front of you and you can follow along with me. I did a PowerPoint because originally I was going to do this live and that didn't work out, but I thought I'd go through it with everyone today, and you'll see in there that I have some questions that I have put together thinking I could interact with you, but that's not going to be possible today, but I will still go through the questions and give you the answers as I think they should be. First, I just want to also just say that hope maybe some of you saw it or all of you saw it. There was an article in the Lakeland Ledger this weekend on March 21st called Statistics Are Grim for Teens Leaving Foster Care. And it just is a good reminder that, unfortunately, the independent living issue is a big one across the state, and that kids that do not get help in transitioning into care just end up or have their chances of ending up in homeless or in prison are great, according to this article. So I'm hoping that all of you can read it. It's called, again, Statistics Are Grim for Teens Leaving Foster Care, March 21st, 2009, the Lakeland Ledger. The first page I have in this presentation is the role of guardian ad litem program. And the reason I put that in there is because I don't work in the guardian ad litem program, but I work in the Legal Aid Society, and we have a project called the Juvenile Advocacy Project. I think our project is fairly unique, probably in the state. Most counties, most circuits don't have us, so we're able to do a lot of things that maybe the guardian is not allowed to under a best interest representation. But I thought I would look at and talk with you just a little bit about best interest representation in the independent living arena. I'm sure you're aware that 409.1451, reading that statute, it's really not a best interest-driven statute. It's a rights-driven statute, an area of law. These are rights that the child shall be given and shall be upheld. So can someone who does best interest, can they really push for that? And I think yes. And then talking with people in the guardian ad litem office, I think it's really not a huge issue and shouldn't be for anyone. That in the best interest, using the best interest model of representation, you can push for these rights, and you should push for these with your judge. It should not come down to a guardian saying that it's not in the best interest for a child.
Hello?
For a child not to have a certain right under the statute, which they are absolutely allowed to. Looking for definition of or anything descriptive on that, I cite the Keffler case that dealt with Social Security benefits as defining best interest as open-ended and potentially vague term, meaning I think you can go beyond your how you approach your work in the other areas of dependency and really push to uphold the independent living rights that are given under the statute. And I say also on that page that you could staff conflict cases if you think that you did have a best interest or a conflict with the child that the program is dealing with. You could ask the judge to get an attorney ad litem appointed. So on the next page, what are the transition issues as we see them? And I'm sure you see them this way in your circuit as well, but education is a huge one. Who's going to pay it? Employment, especially in this day and age when people have been in the workforce for a long, long time are losing their jobs. How do these kids who are transitioning, how are they going to support themselves in finding a job? Having a home so that they're not homeless. I add there, too, having a mentor, which could help them maintain and be self-supportive, someone who they can rely on and help them through a lot of the questions that we've relied on, a lot of the issues that we've relied on our parents for. services, Agency for Persons with Disabilities, which deal with the mentally handicapped, mental health and substance abuse services through when they're under 18 through SAMH, medical and dental problems, how are they going to handle those when they turn 18 on their own, Social Security benefits, are they receiving them before 18, and what happens when they turn 18, do they need to be reapplied for, et cetera. If they have a large amount of money, maybe saved in the master trust that's run by the department or through the CBCs, does someone need to become a guardian of that property? Does someone also need to become a guardian of the child? Is the child low IQ, or do the mental health problems prevent them from really being able to ensure that they can manage their own lives? I put in also last-minute changes. I just recently had a child who we had laid out a whole independent living plan for him. And, of course, with his participation, and 2 weeks before he turns 18, he decided to totally change the plans. And it made it difficult to ensure that he wasn't going to be on the streets, but we were able to work something out. And then also another issue, which is coming up more so, I see, because of the money crunch, is that the actual receipt of services. And in dealing with that issue, knowing the structure of how services are provided in your circuit, and understanding how that the independent living budget is actually spent, and who controls the spending of it, and the eligibility or qualification for that money. All right, so looking at Florida's independent living scheme, I'm going to assume that a lot of you know this, but I'll go through it quickly. I categorize them as pre-transition and transition. For kids under 18, you have the pre-independent living and life skills services, subsidized independent living services, and education and job planning. And the transition, once you are 18, you have Road to Independence program, the aftercare support services, transitional support services, and I add there the extension of jurisdiction. Everything but the extension of jurisdiction, as you know, is in section 409.1451. Extension of jurisdiction, I believe, is in 39.013, and we'll get into that in a moment. So now I just want to go through each of those services, each of those issues we just listed, and just talk a little about them, what makes a child eligible for them, et cetera. And so pre-independent living services, that's 409.1451 for subs A and B. The child has to be at least 13 and under 15 and living in foster care. Any child meeting that has to have an annual staffing. And in this staffing, several things have to be reviewed, but the main intent here is to ensure that the child and all those supporting the child have developed an educational and career path. And that path needs to be placed into a case plan. And I was thinking as I was reviewing this again today, how often do I really see that done for these children? And it's not too often. So I question if in those staffings that are occurring for these kids, done by the, hopefully you have in your circuit, some independent living case manager. I'm just wondering whether any of this is getting done in the staffings and whether the staffings are really occurring. There needs to be a pre-independent living assessment. In our circuit, which is Circuit 15, we have what's called the Ansel Casey. I think I've heard that not everyone uses the Ansel Casey, and there might be another assessment used across the state. I understand there's four different varieties or different tests given under the Ansel Casey name, and so one of them is what would be considered this pre-independent living assessment. You should get familiar in your circuit what is actually used for that assessment and the differences between each of the levels that are given to hopefully correspond with what the statute requires. The services include, and I state in bold, but are not limited to, life skills training, educational field trips, and conferences. So to me, that says at minimum they need to have those, but there's other things that your creativity and the child's needs can create. Another thing that I found interesting in the statute and that I don't see too often is that this report needs to be generated concerning the staffing and the development of that educational career path, and that report needs to be signed by the child, and then that report would get attached to a judicial review. I don't know about you, but I rarely see something like that. And it might be beneficial to ensure that those reports are actually created, those staffings actually happen, the career and educational paths are actually created for the child, and that this gets reviewed at these judicial reviews. Another pre-transition service is the life skills services. This is for a child who is now 15 but not yet 18 and must again be living in foster care. There must now, instead of an annual staffing, be a staffing every 6 months that ensures that appropriate independent living training and services are being received and that are there to evaluate the progress of the child in developing the skills needed to be independent. Another assessment needs to be done. There's actually two that are done during this, the 15 to 18 period. A life skills assessment. This assessment looks at services, or the department is supposed to use that assessment to develop services and training specific to that child. And if you've looked at any of those assessments, so the Ansel Casey, for example, has the child go through a lot of scenarios and has the child say whether that's a lot like me, somewhat like me, or not like me. And using those answers, they can develop a training program and services specific to the child. I'm not convinced that, in our circuit anyway, maybe it's different in yours, but that we actually provide truly specific training based on the child's needs as developed in the assessment. So it might be something you want to look at with each child that you are helping out. Another assessment that's done after the child turns 18 is the independent living assessment. This determines the child's skills and abilities to live independently and to become self-sufficient. Again, it's another a lot like me, somewhat like me, not like me type of assessment. But hopefully, by then, there's been some growth looking at all the prior assessments and considering the training they hopefully have been getting to see if they are progressing and understanding what all the skills and everything they need to know in order to become independent. Again, a report needs to be generated and attached to the JR and signed by the child is something I'm going to actually jump on here in Circuit 15 because I actually never see that. I have a fact and issue page there, which I want to talk about a little bit. If a child, the facts are these, the child lives in a group home, the community-based care provider is contracted to provide independent living, but the group home provides the independent living training. Is the issue is the training received by the child contemplated by the legislature? And why is that such a big deal? It appears to me because the statute in sub 4 of 409.1451 says DCF provides, is to provide these services. Does that mean they cannot contract out? No, it doesn't. So the CBC could provide them, but can the CBC then have the group home, let's say, that the child lives in, or the foster home that the child lives in, or wherever the child lives, maybe even in an RTC placement, can they require them to give the independent living training? There, that's where I'm not so convinced. But it happens a lot, and what I'm concerned about is that the quality of the training is inconsistent. There might be actually a group home that does an amazing training, but there might be another group home where the training is not so great. Are they really following the assessments and Ansel Casey, the life skills assessments that have been done for the child, are they really giving specific training for that child, or is it just training made for the majority? So I question that this is really what the legislature contemplated, and we're working here in the county and in our circuit to actually look at how we train the children and hopefully change that. So it may be that not a big issue, but you may want to look at it to see, to be sure that the children are actually receiving training specific to themselves and that they're actually receiving it by the CBC, maybe in a consistent, really thought-out, thorough curriculum that will deal with all issues that are needed to be addressed before a child turns 18 and ages out. All right, another pre-transition program is the Subsidized Independent Living Service Program. And I heard a judge here in our circuit once say that there are so few kids in this program that, which was surprising to me because I thought there were quite a lot, and maybe there are some in your circuit, but I guess we don't have as many as could be. As you know, this is in a living arrangement where the child can live in an apartment on his own, his or her own. There is not someone who lives with them, or there could be, but usually or sometimes there's not someone who really lives with them, although they are monitored by a dependency case manager or an independent living case manager on a fairly consistent basis. The services are provided as part of an overall plan to ensure that the child leaves totally independent from the department. And there are payments that are made to the child, subsidy payments that can be made directly to the child or to an adult approved by DCF, and maybe that's the child's independent living case manager or dependency case manager or somebody who can help the child with his budget. What are the qualifications for subsidized independent living? When the child is 16 or 17 years old, obviously dependent on when they come into care, they must be evaluated for subsidized independent living. No child is accepted from that. Assuming they are adjudicated dependent, they are in licensed out-of-home care for the prior 6 months, and have a permanency goal of adoption, independent living, or long-term licensed care, and demonstrate independent living skills. I want to point out that the statute has not been updated to reflect the current permanency goals as they're described in 39. And it's no longer called independent living, but it's called APLA, as you know. Long-term licensed care is not there any longer, but could fit permanent guardianship or I forget what the other one is. But demonstrating independent living skills as determined by the department using established procedures and assessments. I'm not sure really what the legislature meant by that. The department has developed a rule that explains this, but I don't know if actually the rule is the established procedures and assessments. Not really a big issue, but something to think about. The rule was actually developed in May of 2006, and it's Rule 65C-28.009 called Adolescent Services. And Subpart 7 deals with subsidized independent living. In there, the department has listed a bunch of criteria that the child must satisfy. The child must be either part-time employed or involved in extracurricular activities important to the child's personal development. A child must have a sufficient earned savings. I'm going to assume that that's from the job that the child is, because of the word earned, that the child is working at, and can't be any other benefits that maybe the child is receiving. The child must be in enrolled full-time in school, must have maintained adequate progress with his or her grades. There must be a skills assessment done on the child, which demonstrates the ability to perform independent living skills, fairly sufficiently. The behavior of the child must be responsible and must have letters of reference. And in order to determine the eligibility of the child and review these criteria, there must be a staffing, and the CBC and or DCF, whoever is assigned it under the contract in your area, would have to then approve the child for the services. Question I always have with rules is this: even though the statute says established procedures and assessments, and they had developed this rule, is it really contemplated or what? But all right, so I just recently had a subsidized independent living case, and it's been a real eye opener for me. And so I developed this fact set here, kind of based on what happened to one of my kids. The child is 16 years old and lived in licensed out-of-home care since she was 11. She's adjudicated dependent, has the APLA case plan goal, and DCF has actually gone ahead and done the staffing and approved her for services. So great, she's going to get this subsidized independent living. But she lives in a community where DCF has no established relationship with the landlords. She doesn't live in our circuit, but in another circuit, and our local CBC doesn't have any relationship with landlords there, nor does the courtesy worker. Will the child be blocked from receiving the services? And surprisingly, it could happen. The issues that come up is you have to find the landlord who's willing to take in a 16 or 17-year-old. There are not a lot of landlords who are willing to do it. The next thing is the child's got to be able to sign the lease. But if the child is 16 and not yet 17, they cannot sign the lease because the disability of non-age is not removed until they're 17. what happened to my child, she was able to sign a lease, but the landlord wanted a guarantor. And there's nothing in the statute, the rules, or anything that talks about that. And it seems reasonable that a landlord would want a guarantor to sign the lease. But who is that? Is it the department? Is it up to the child to find some other adult that should sign on as a guarantor? So it comes down to this: it's great the child could qualify for subsidized independent living, but can they actually get the services? I've had to go in and actually ask the department, to compel the department to sign as the guarantor. I actually lost that motion and was going to take it to the fourth, but we were able. A child actually found a guarantor after that, and so that issue has not gone up, but I'm looking for it, and to me, the department should be signing. Otherwise, the child does not get the services, and the statute says that DCF shall serve if a child is eligible. So that's it on subsidized independent living. Section 409.1451 also talks about education and job planning that are to start for a child in foster care at age 13. This is to be done by either DCF or your CBC, and they are to really plan for post-secondary education and for a career path. The case plan, again, as I already mentioned earlier, has to include the education and career path that was developed and with the child, and it's based on, in the statute, the abilities and interests of the child. And the child can change those paths at any time. Those paths are reviewed at each judicial hearing. For post-secondary education under the statute, the child has four options and has to select one of them. Attending a four-year college, receiving a two-year degree, probably from a community college, attaining a post-secondary career and technical certificate, or beginning immediate employment after completing high school, receiving a GED, or enlisting in military. So this plan was something that should have been developed from 13 or whenever they came into care after that age, and should be in the case plan and acted on and being implemented. The fact situation I developed to talk about some issues is the child is behind 2 years in school, but remains on a standard diploma track with a 2.0 GPA. Child will age out in 5 months and wants to complete her high school education. She wants to be a nurse. The issue there is the child's school and the dependency case manager want to change her track from diploma to GED, but the child doesn't want it. So does the child need to agree to the must the child agree to the change? And the answer is no. But I've had this issue where the school is forcing a change in the child's education path, and somehow the DCM has decided that that's a good idea as well. But the child wants to maintain and graduate, getting a standard diploma and just complete the high school path and then move on. But the school is concerned because the child's going to be like 20 when she graduates. So they're trying to force the child into a GED path. And fortunately, I see this quite a lot. And I'm not sure that's the best idea for these kids, because the GED path, while it may get them a degree and allow them to go to, in our county anyway, to Palm Beach Community College, it's not necessarily the best thing for a child. And if the child doesn't want it, I think you should really advocate for them and with the school and with the department that they be allowed to complete their education as they see it. It may require, though, that a surrogate parent get appointed to help out the child with the school. If you're not familiar with surrogate parents, it's in the education law where a child in foster care must have a surrogate parent at the school meetings to assist them. Okay, the Road to Independence program is one of the big ones in 409.1451, if not the one that every kid, when you talk to them, seems to know about from word of mouth, Section 5B. It's created to help kids receive educational and vocational training needed to achieve independence. The maximum amount currently that can get paid to a child is $1,135 a month. That amount is reviewed, as I understand it, every July. and can be adjusted and is adjusted based on the federal minimum wage. So if the minimum wage goes up again this year before July, I believe then the state will readjust the maximum amount payable. The minimum amount is $25. That doesn't seem like much of a help for any child. A lot of the kids that I represent do receive the maximum, and they do rely on it greatly. The calculation for the benefit, it takes in other money that the child is receiving, and that benefit ends when the child attains one of the four post-secondary goals that we just talked about in the education, when I was talking about education, or when the child reaches 23. To be eligible for this amount of money, there's an initial award and a renewal award. For the initial award, the child needs to be 18 to 20 years old or must have earned a standard diploma or its equivalent or a special diploma or its equivalent. And I had to read that many times because I thought you would have to have some sort of a diploma or something to get the Road to Independence Scholarship, but it just says you have to be a certain age. In this one section, it's 409.1451, sub 5B2. Obviously, there's other things that are necessary I'm going to go through in a minute. Renewal award, you just have to be under 23 years of age. The initial award is renewed every year until the child is either 23 or no longer in the program. And that renewal is considered, and I'll talk about it in a minute, but 90 days before their next birthday. The child must be a dependent child, living in foster care or subsidized independent living when she turns 18, or currently in foster care or subsidized independent living. On those two requirements there, and it's an or, so all you need is one of those requirements, I was trying to figure out, is there a real distinction between them? Because you have to be 18 to get the Road to Independence money, and I'm not clear that there's a distinction between these two. I mean, you have to be in foster care or subsidized independent living when you turn 18 to get this award. So if anyone knows the difference between those, let me know. The other thing is they can be at least 16, adopted or placed with a guardian, and if this option applies, they have to have spent 6 months in foster care immediately preceding the placement or adoption. All children must have at least 6 months living in foster care before turning 18. They must be a resident of Florida, and they must either have earned a diploma or a special diploma and have been admitted to a full-time enrollment into a post-secondary education institution or enrolled full-time in accredited high school or enrolled full-time in an accredited adult education program, a GED program. The Road to Independence program and all these post-18 or 18 and older services are governed by, or the department has enacted a rule, and it's in Chapter 65C-31, the Road to Independence Aftercare and Transition. Anyway, the Road to Independence requires the child be a full-time student. And what does that mean? In our circuit, we've had questions of what that really means. Well, it's not defined by DCF or CBC. The statute specifically says they cannot define that. The educational institution has to define that. So for each educational institution in your circuit, you may have a different requirement or different definition of what a full-time student is. So don't rely on just on one that is maybe for the community college you have and down the street, and the one in another city may have a totally different definition of full-time student. It sounds silly, but we've run across that issue here where the definitions all vary from institution to institution. If you have a recognized disability, you do not have to attend full-time. A renewal, like I said, is done annually and begins 90 days prior to the child's next birthday. The renewal award eligibility, you must, again, complete full-time education hours for the past year, and full-time, again, is defined by the educational institution. You must maintain appropriate progress, and those words, I put them in quotes because they're out of the statute, and that's also defined by the educational institution. I'm going to assume, and reading the rules and the statute, that it's obviously grades that you are getting appropriate grades that would allow you to keep moving up into and getting closer to your diploma. And then one-time reinstatement allowed for youth not qualifying for renewal who has chosen not to renew. You actually, if this is a, this reinstatement is, I guess let me back up a second. There's three ways after your initial award to keep getting the road to independence and under the statute. You can get a renewal award, a reinstatement of your award, or a restoration of your award. So the renewal I just explained, if you don't get the renewal or you, or the child chose not to renew, they can reinstate their award using the renewal criteria, which are the completing full-time education and maintaining appropriate progress. You can restore your eligibility if you, that's where a child has lost eligibility because they weren't maintaining progress. If the child has now gotten up to speed with his educational institution and is actually progressing as the educational institution believes they should in order to get their degree. All right, I have many factual scenarios.
I know what he's talking about, but I'm...
I can hear you.
Anyway, what he's talking about.
All right, I have many factual scenarios in this. That we get so many issues on the road to independence in our circuit. I'm assuming the rest of you do, too. So I just wanted to go through some. Some are really basic, and some are a little different. If a child is 17 years old and has lived in foster care for 3 months, her independent living plan calls for her to remain with her foster family, paying rent using the RTI. 2 months later, she ages out of living in foster care. Is she eligible for these benefits? And the trick there, there has to be the 6 months to get the road to independence. So unfortunately, this child, with only 5 months, unless you can fashion some sort of argument to get around that six-month requirement, you're not going to get this child care. What I have done in the past with kids like this, some children go in and out of care over many years, and maybe their latest stint in care has been this 5 month period that I have in this example. But what I would do is go back into the file, core file, or I'd get with DCF and review all other prior shelters or other times in care, and then add up all those times to get to the 6 months. And I've done that many times with DCF. I've also even taken the position that their investigation was done on the child and they chose not to shelter. I've argued that actually in that scenario, I had the child, they were going to shelter the child, but the child ran. And if the child had not run, they would have taken the child into care. If you had counted the time that they were going to take that child, but for the child running, the child I represented would have had the 6 months. I was able to convince the department that they shouldn't hold these benefits away from this child, but for the child running. The child was running for reasons related to the shelter and other issues. So it's a good thing to look back to see the history of the child and not just look at the current placement or what put them into care in order to get past that six-month requirement. Another example I have is a child turned 18 last week. Lived in foster care for 2 years after being adjudicated dependent. He lives with his cousin, and he moved into his cousin's home a week before turning 18, and he's applied for the RTI. Will he get those benefits? And I say no, and under this example, because the rule is that he has to be in foster care when he turns 18. There's a lot of creative ways to deal with this, and I don't know if anyone's on the phone from Hillsborough, but I know I've heard that Judge Bauman over there will consider the child on a visit, for example, a court-ordered visit or something, and will not hold the actual being with the cousin a week before, for example, against the child to deny the RTI. I've had a child who had a month to go before he aged out, but wanted to move into his home that he's going to live in when he turns 18. And I was able to get an order similar along those lines that he would go on a 30-day visit and still be considered in foster care. So there's some creative ways you can get around this requirement. Another question or issue. The youth gets RTI, turns 19, and moves out of the state to attend college. Does he remain eligible for RTI? Well, you have a requirement that the child be a resident of Florida. So I think you have to look at, and if going to school in that state, do they maintain some contact here? Do they maintain a home, some sort of residential contact here? I mean, I had a circumstance like this where the child is maintaining, even though he came in foster care, the foster family was willing to take him back once he was done with college. So I was able to convince the provider that they should consider this child, continue to consider this child a resident. And I believe there's some law on that as well. I have another circumstance where the child is getting out of high school this year, has turned 19, and then is moving with his uncle in Pennsylvania and will be going to school there. Now, does that child qualify? Is the residence now Pennsylvania or Florida? It became a tricky issue. I was able to convince our provider that for, I think, the first year that he would be considered a resident of Florida in order for the RTI to continue, but they wouldn't agree beyond that. Another issue, a youth lived out of care, out of state with a relative who has who was a licensed foster care placement. Is this child eligible for RTI benefits? I came across an issue where I got appointed to two kids. They would otherwise qualify for RTI, but they didn't live in foster care in this state. They had been placed with their grandparents in another state. And the issue was they needed the RTI. They'd been in foster care for many years, but for being placed with their grandparents, they weren't getting the RTI. It turned out that in this state, any child placed with anyone had to become licensed, even if it was a relative. So they became licensed, and we got a court order that this was considered licensed foster care because the department sought the placement, and those children are receiving the benefits today. Another example, a youth receives RTI and attends school regularly. She's pregnant, and when she has her baby, her doctor wants her to remain at home for 6 weeks. Can she continue to receive RTI? And the answer is yes. There's actually, I was looking through the rules today, 65C-31.005 sub 11. It's in the transitional section, but it does discuss pregnancy, and it seems pretty broad in that section, even though the title of that section is transition. At that point in the rule, the discussion of everything has gotten broader. Our local independent living provider did agree that the child would continue to receive RTI even though she wasn't going to be in school. She just had to provide a doctor's statement, and that seems sufficient. Another issue that's not in your packet but that has come up is if a child goes to Job Corps, will they get RTI? And RTI requires that you're in some sort of an educational tract, and Job Corps is both education and vocation. So I think it would come down to what the child was actually doing with Job Corps. If they were in school in some form, I think you would have an argument to say that a child in Job Corps would qualify for the RTI. Another issue that has come up is, let's say a child is graduating high school, going to post-secondary education, but has a summer off, essentially, has got accepted, doesn't start till August, but turned 18 in May. Can they start to receive the RTI when they turn 18, or do they have to wait until they're actually in school? Well, the statute says the child needs to be enrolled in an institution, educational institution. Does that necessarily mean they must be actually going to school at that point? I think the argument would be is that they are enrolled and that their time to actually begin school and progress begins in August when the school is requiring them to start. So I think you have an argument to say that the RTI should begin when they turn 18 as opposed to waiting until they start school in August. Okay, aftercare support services. These are services that are not limited to what I've listed, but this is what's listed in the statute: mentoring, tutoring, mental health, substance abuse counseling, life skills, parenting, job, career, and financial literacy skills, temporary financial assistance, and temporary assistance to prevent homelessness. Child has to be 18 but not yet 23 and must leave foster care at 18. The eligibility is determined by the department. There's a needs assessment that is done. to determine the child's needs, and the services are provided by DCF or the CBC. Issues that have come up on this, on aftercare support, is the child receives aftercare support services immediately after turning 18 in order to move into an apartment. The child has now moved again and needs further assistance. Are these services a one-time payment? I don't consider it to be a one-time payment. The statute doesn't say that it's a one-time payment. I think where the argument comes in my circuit and on maybe in your circuits too is that Rule 65C-31.003(3)(c) kind of implies that this is a one-time payment, although it's really not specifically stated. I've had the I've heard the local independent living provider argue that it is a one-time. I'm not necessarily convinced with that. So just to be aware of that. Additional facts in that same scenario, the youth's home needs maintenance repairs. Can these services be paid, used to pay for repairs? I think the answer is yes, because the aftercare does pay temporary financial assistance and temporary assistance to prevent homelessness. I'm not sure if repairs to a home are actually what is contemplated there, but I think it's broad enough to actually argue that. This did come up in one of our cases, and the independent living provider agreed to pay the repairs using aftercare money. Maybe if aftercare wouldn't be agreed to, you might be able to try transitional funding, but which we'll get to in a minute, but it's harder, more stricter guidelines to get transition. An additional facts to the scenario is the child was in foster care for 5 months. Is she eligible for services? And the answer is yes. There's no time requirement for aftercare support services. On transitional support services, these are appropriate short-term funding and services. And I put the list there, and it's a pretty full list of everything that could be used to help the child, including an other stated in there. It says short-term funding. If you look at Rule 65C-31.005(4)(b), the department has interpreted short-term funding to mean 3 months. Whether that's actually what was contemplated by the legislature is, I'm unsure, but it's if you wanted to litigate that, you could. Eligible, you must be 18 but less than 23, formerly in foster care, dependent child under Chapter 39, living in licensed foster care or subsidized independent living when turn 18, and at least 6 months in foster care before turning 18. The eligibility, again, is determined by the department or the CBC. The child has to show that the services are critical to the child receiving or achieving self-sufficiency and developing a personal support system. And I noted, too, that in the rule for this service, the department uses the on reapplication for these type of services, the child must show that the services are vital. Whether there's a distinction between critical and vital, I'm not clear on, but just to point that out to you. The services terminate when no longer critically needed. And a joint transition plan must be developed that includes transition support services will be used to help the child achieve self-sufficiency, and the child has to be accountable and must complete them. So you could almost read that as somewhat of a case plan for a child, in a sense. An issue I've seen in transition is the youth has a critical need for financial services but is not in school. Is the youth eligible for transition services? And the answer is yes. In fact, I hear our independent living provider here often saying if the child isn't if the child can't get the RTI, we'll just go with transition for as long as needed. But that really doesn't solve the problem since the transition is a short-term funding for a short-term period. The next thing I talk about are the judicial reviews under 39701, which are important in to ensure that the child is there's a plan in place for the child to age out, that the plan is actually being implemented, and that it's a way of actually having a court monitor and ensure that the department and whoever else is involved with the child is actually getting the job done to ensure this child is not homeless and that we're not trying to resolve these big issues right before the child ages out. 90 days after the 17th birthday, you probably have this in hopefully in all your circuits, that, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong thing, but the disability of non-age is removed to allow youth to sign a lease after they're 17, and that's within 90 days after 17. The statute says shall be entered. That order shall be entered, although I've had judges here in our circuit say no. I haven't brought that up to the fourth because I don't, well, it hasn't been too important, but just to point that out, you can have as many JRs as possible until the child turns 18. Obviously, whether you're going to get them or not is up to your judge or your magistrate, whoever handles them in your circuit. But we've had them in some cases weekly just to ensure that the department is doing everything that needs to be done to have get the child self-sufficient and to ensure all the services are in place before a child transitions out of foster care. The child, as you know, has the right to talk to the court and express his or her wishes to a court. After 17, the case plan must list all services that the child has received since the child has been in foster care or at least since the age of 13. And a court may issue an order to show cause to the department for why they are not providing these services and obviously in hopes to get the services provided as quickly as possible. DCF, you have to, in these JRs, DCF has to verify that the child has all the documents that I've listed there and that they've received training for independent living and a bank account and that they have a clear understanding of where they're living. That the child has been given a notice or has been noticed of how to file for a petition for extended jurisdiction. Also, they've been given information on eligible benefits, including the RTI, accessing their master trust funds, and other public assistance. Extension of jurisdiction. This jurisdiction, as you know, jurisdiction ends at 18. It can be extended to 19 when the if the child so desires. And it seems it's appropriate to assist the child in getting aftercare transition and RTI services, and also mental health and developmental disability services. What I see here sometimes in the circuit that I'm in is that the extension of jurisdiction is necessary for independent living services, and there's no provision in the law for that. I don't know how that misconception got started here, but as often as I can, I say that's no provision. Hopefully you don't have anyone believing that in your circuit. On this, I wrote this example of a fact situation that the guardian represents the program or the guardian attorney and the volunteer represents the best interest of the child. Does or can the guardian attorney file a motion to extend jurisdiction? Well, the child has the right to petition the court for extension. And if the child wants to do that, if the child is not doing it in the JRs, hopefully they're being brought to the JRs after they're 17 and are attending, and hopefully they remember that they can extend jurisdiction simply by asking the court. If that's not happening, should the guardian attorney actually ask for that? And I believe they should. I've heard opposite from some. I'm hoping that's just a minority. We certainly do that for our clients. We file and ensure that the jurisdiction is extended if the child wants it. We try to convince them to have it because it seems a good benefit for the child. What happens if a child is as a low IQ, like an IQ of 50, is mentally delayed or something? I think then you still should, like we do, we ask that jurisdiction be extended to ensure that someone is watching over the child, to ensure that all the services are being made. I'm not sure a child with an IQ of 50, for example, could really make that decision, so it gets made for them. And I believe the ethics rules under the minority rule would allow that. Okay, actual receipt of services. This is in here because of the budget crunch. I think it's really important, and it's become important in our circuit, to actually understand how the services are received, delivered, et cetera. It requires that if in your circuit you do have a distinction between a dependency case manager and an independent living case manager, understand who is doing what and when. Sometimes you get into a JR, and the DCM has not done the JRSSR, nor has the independent living case manager. They both thought the other was doing it. It's important for you to understand how it's set up in your community to ensure that gets done. I find, too, that to understand how the services are delivered in the county, it's really helpful in court if I have reviewed the CBC's contract with the department to understand what their requirements under the independent living statute are. And if for any subcontractor that the CBC has contracted with for independent living, I think it's beneficial to look at that contract to understand exactly what that subcontractor is to provide so that you can deal with it accordingly in court. The independent living budget impacts on service availability, eligibility, and delivery. Availability, pre-transition services under that subsection 4 and 409.1451 are not conditioned on fund availability. So despite any budget, those services must be provided. And so there's no argument by the DCF or your CBC that those services cannot be provided because they haven't been funded. Unfortunately, under subsection 5, which is all the 18-plus services, they are conditioned on fund availability. So it's important to know what your CBC has in terms of funding received from the department for the services under 409.1451. I'm noticing in our circuit that eligibility for our clients is being addressed on a more stricter basis than it was before. It seemed like things were a little looser before the budget got really tight. And now that the budget is tight, they are really being strict on the criteria and actually interpreting some of the criteria stricter than I think the legislature or even the rules intend. So if you're having problems with getting a child eligible or if there's problems that arise in court with eligibility, you may want to look at what the independent living provider is actually saying and to the child, what they're actually placing on applications for the child to get the services. You may find that they're just construing the statute and the rules stricter than necessary. And then once the child is found eligible and the services are being delivered, I'm finding, too, now a strict, much more strict and conservative view of how the child maintains eligibility and gets renewal of especially the RTI. It's come up with what does full-time education mean and what does maintain progress, adequate progress in educational institution. Although that's supposed to be defined by the educational institution, I'm finding that there's a lot more structure or strictness put into the interpretation of that, and kids are being removed from RTI for reasons that might not necessarily be valid. So it's important to see and understand why the child is might have lost services that were previously being delivered. Okay, advocating to solve the transition issues. Obviously, the child's participation in the planning of the issues is key, and it's key that the child participate in the court hearing so that the court can actually hear the child and understand the child's needs. And it's important, actually, for everyone in that courtroom to actually understand that child and what that child wants. It's not always clear from paperwork or from pleadings what truly that child needs when they turn 18. So it's good for the court to actually hear from the child. I wrote plan ahead. That's an obvious one. But it's so important to make sure, because you want to be sure all your pleadings are in line, all the court orders are in place that will ensure eligibility for the child. A placement's found, education is all set up, everything is in line, so there's like this seamless transition when the child turns 18, and so that when all the services hopefully get approved and start being given to the child, there's no disruption in them, and they can move from turning 17 to 18 and still maintain their life that they are having. And a lot of them are still in high school or whatever track they're on, so there's no disruption in that at all. Hopefully the child doesn't have to move out of their school district, other issues like that. I think, too, it's important to make sure the child understands his or her rights under that statute. In our circuit, we have people who do staffings, independent living staffings for these kids, but they're not lawyers. They don't necessarily explain everything appropriately, correctly, or adequately under the law. And it might be good for you to attend some of these staffings to hear how the rights are being explained to the children. I realized that with one of the kids I represented that there was a problem when he thought all he had to actually do was be enrolled in school and never attend. But there comes a point where you have to attend. He just didn't understand that, and obviously that was my fault. I didn't make sure he understood it. I made sure he understood it when he asked me that question, but it showed me that these staffings where all these rights and benefits are discussed, it's probably very overwhelming for them, and they're not understanding it entirely, even though they'll tell you, they'll tell the court, they'll tell everyone else involved that they do understand it. They truly don't understand the really basic aspects of the rights that they have, and I fear that they'll lose them if they don't. Advocating to solve the transition issues, obviously know the law and the rules. That's a no-brainer. I already told you all the youth rules, the 18-plus rules, are in Chapter 65C-31. Aftercare is 31.003, RTI is 31.004, and transition is 31.005. The pre-transition is in 65C-28.009. I think, too, it's so important when you're dealing with independent living kids that you know what is available in your area in terms of independent living benefits and services, including where these kids can live, how the service is provided through how many contracts are needed to actually provide the services, who is actually providing them, and also relying on your website resources that are that Mary Kay talked about earlier. I think it's very important that the independent living plan be in place before the child is 18. It sounds like an obvious, but it seems to me, from what I hear and what I see in our circuit, a lot of planning is done right before the child turns 18. The child gets anxious, scared, because they don't know where they're going to live. It's so important to work on this early and often and keep revisiting the issue. Every JR, make sure every right is gone through with the child and with the court, and that everything is being addressed, and that there is a timeline and a whole time frame to ensure that these services will be provided seamlessly to this child, so the child can avoid the stress and frustration and all the emotions that come with aging out and losing the support system that they do have. We in Palm Beach County, in our unit, we assist these kids past 18. I don't know if under the law the guardian ad litem program can. I would love to see a change to that, because there are so many issues for the child from 18 to 19 in terms of them continuing to understand how to continue to receive their benefits, especially the RTI, which they become very dependent on, and especially maintaining a home, which they have no idea how to maintain and keep in the first place. How we do it here in our county, we have gone out, reached out to our DCF director, our CBC director, the independent living provider, and our Agency for Persons with Disabilities provider, and we've met with them. We have relationships with them. We're able to get them on the phone at the drop of a hat and solve problems as needed, because they do come up quickly, and I really recommend that and that you do that in your circuits as well. Also develop a relationship with your CBC RevMax or Benefits Department, and I add also your Social Security Administration, because you will have kids who are getting Social Security benefits, and although I'm not dealing with it here, there's a whole issue concerning the transition of them when they turn 18 regarding their SSI benefits, their death benefits, what is needed, does another application need to be filed. You need to get familiar with those rules under Social Security, and maybe even just talk with the RevMax person who deals with that. Also get familiar, if you aren't already, with your service providers in the community for all the other issues that the child may have, like mental health or substance abuse, and the services they need, and ensure that those services are in place. In our county, we have an independent living stakeholder group that meets once a month to review how independent living is progressing. It may be, if you don't have one in your circuit, that something gets established like that, so that all of you as a community and a group can work towards a seamless transition. And what we've done in our circuit and has been done in Hillsboro by Judge Bauman, independent living court has been established. I believe they've done that somewhat in Miami and in Tallahassee. What a benefit to these kids to have that. We actually went to the judges here, and we have been able to get it established in some of the divisions. Not all, unfortunately, but it's made such a difference for the kids in those divisions. Very few problems arise that are emergent anymore, and which is a nice thing. Finally, just to sum up a little bit, we are very motion practice oriented. We basically ensure that all orders in place remove all eligibility issues from the child. There are some things that only the child can control, but if there's a question about whether the child's been 6 months in care or is living in care at 18, I want an order that establishes that. I see it's 1 o'clock, so the other stuff is pretty explanatory. Mary did attach the information I got yesterday on SIJJ. There's going to be a whole new rule rewriting of the immigrants. And whether they get services, please read those materials. They will help you in court with dealing with these type of kids. And I will leave it at that.
And I know, Bill, do you have a few minutes to take questions?
Yes.
And before we start the questions, just a couple of things I wanted to just comment on briefly. I know Bill commented on whether or not guardian ad litems attorneys would be requesting extension of jurisdictions. Our attorneys do that all the time. It's on the JR checklist that they provide. So I'm sure all of y'all are doing that. And if you're not, you need to be doing that. And I have never, and I don't think anyone with us, we've never heard an issue with a judge not allowing the guardian ad litem program to make that request on behalf of the child. And if you do get an issue, you know, there's a form motion on the website. You should be able to just ask for it at that judicial review. If you have to file a motion, we have a form motion for you, so you can do that. The big thing is, Steve, as Bill mentioned, is you've got to make sure it's in the order from your judicial review, especially if you haven't filed a motion, you just requested it ori tenis. Also wanted to just touch on the post-18 issue. We do stay on cases past 18 for extended jurisdiction cases. If you're not doing that and you don't and you want to, talk to your supervising attorney, because we do that in lots of places, so that shouldn't be an issue. Also, in terms of the independent living courts, just so you know, Bill, they are cropping up all over the place. I think we did just an informal canvassing for Chief Justice Quince had asked me to look into that, and most circuits have something. Now, they're only usually in the bigger counties in those circuits. It may not be in a formal independent living court, but it's a they do some sort of special docket for the older kids. If your circuit isn't doing that and you want to start one, feel free to let me know, and I could hook you up with some folks. I know, for example, the Eighth Circuit, Susan, the supervising attorney there, has been instrumental in getting that one off the ground. It starts next month. So, you know, again, if you want to get that going in your circuit, just let us know. And with that, I will hand it over to you guys for questions.